The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Like an addiction to Facebook or Twitter, you are now inseparable from Skeptically Speaking, where we brainwash you into calling in and questioning everything. Here beside me tonight is the one swinging the shiny gold watch, your hostess Desiree. Skeptically Speaking begins right now, so take it away, Des.
Thanks, Sean. Just so you guys know, he doesn't actually allow me to hear those beforehand, so they're always a surprise. So today on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about UFOs with Jim Maroney, director of the Alberta UFO Study Group. Yes, lovelies, UFOs. So do gather your most insightful and penetrating, that was totally an anal probe joke, questions together, and we'll open up the lines shortly. Good. So, actually, why don't we, while you fiddle with things, with buttons that I don't understand, why don't I actually talk about some of the things that are coming up?
That would be great.
We have some events. What do we got? The next Caffeinating Skeptically, actually, is Tuesday, April 28th at Remedy Cafe. And for anybody that actually lives in Edmonton, that's right on the corner of 109th and 86th Ave. And myself and Sean and possibly our wonderful intern Ryan and various other people will be there talking about all kinds of nerdy things from about 7:30 to 9:30. Also, the Day of Reason, we mentioned it last show, but this is your official reminder. It's Thursday, May 7th. If you want to know how to get involved, how to give blood, because it, you know, helps rather than the day of prayer. I don't know what they do. I think they pray. So we donate blood. Go to the Society of Edmonton Atheists website at blog.edmontonatheists.ca. So do we have our speaking up person on the line?
I believe we do. James, are you there? Curious. Curious indeed. We will get him going on the Skypes here in just a moment then.
You know, we'll do.
Brownie in motion.
Today with Brownie in motion.
Yes.
Lovely. So, folks, I love technical issues, honestly. Okay. Now, Brownie in motion, yes, he can talk about whatever he's going to talk about in a moment. But first of all, I was actually reading Ferengula today, lovey.
Oh, no.
And you were on there a bunch, actually. And actually, just for those of you that don't know, Brownie in is one of Ferengula's, and Ferengula is P.C. Meyer's blog about biology and atheism. He's one of the regular commenters. And actually, he's even won a Molly. And which, that's PZ's version of an Oscar, right?
Yes, it's named after Molly Ivins, the Texas columnist who is known for her irascible wit. I don't know how I won one, because, I mean, mostly what I do is get angry and let loose with streams of invective. But on occasion, I do write something relatively insightful,
or at least some people seem to think so. It's streams of invective, but it's also, you provide a lot of links to a lot of different studies, and you... Yes, you swear, but it's insightful swearing.
Ah, well, thank you, if such a thing could be happening. Before I talk about that, actually, I don't know if anybody managed to catch 30 Rock last night, but Salma Hayek is on it, and she was wearing a t-shirt that said, "What the Frack?" It was kind of awesome. So I was sort of halfway listening, watching, doing something else. And then all of a sudden I noticed, what the frack?
If anyone, by any chance, that listens to this show didn't watch Battlestar Galactica, and I don't see how that is possible. But if you didn't, frack is what they say all the time.
Yeah, and if you haven't been watching that, then you should turn off the radio right now.
And go watch all the old episodes.
Exactly, exactly.
Except for the very last one, I suggest not watching it.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Okay. I was so disappointed.
Okay.
What was happening on Fringula today? PZ wrote a post about... Oh, I can't remember what it was, but it had something to do with some priest saying that morality was encoded in our DNA somehow, and something like that. And later on in this stream of comments, and I wasn't really able to do it until I was done work and read up on it, but there was an individual that was saying, well, okay, you've rejected that hypothesis that God is written into our genes and morality comes from that, so what are the alternatives? So first of all, one of the things I find that subject really, really fascinating, particularly because it deals with anthropology, which is my first subject of study and my favorite. And particularly, so I brought up Mark Hauser's book, The Moral Minds, and how it is that we might have evolved, how we might have evolved the neurological machinery to understand morality. And he links it, basically, I recommend to anybody go out and get the book, but he links it in the same way that Chomsky talked about a universal grammar that we're born with that enables us to learn language. And then what happens is whatever language we're constrained with due to the culture that we grow up in, most cultures actually speak more than one language. So it's rare for cultures to be unilingual like ours is for the most part. But that then once you learn those languages, your ability to, you know, all the extra machinery that's not used for that particular language kind of falls by the wayside. And that's one of the reasons that as we age, we're less able to learn languages with the ease that we can when we're infants. So Mark Hauser makes a similar kind of case, suggesting that we as well have this moral machinery that sits there, this framework then that we place things into. So basically I was using as an example our ability to feel revulsion towards certain things. And particularly, I think a good example is food, because it demonstrates how relatively arbitrary that revulsion is. You know, and that some cultures eat bugs, and we find that gross. And my grandmother, for instance, came from Croatia, and to her, corn was something that was absolutely repulsive to eat, because that's what you fed to pigs. So the idea of humans eating corn was absolutely bizarre and gross. So it just kind of shows, you know, what's, you know, food for one is certainly not for the other. But it plays into why certain individuals might find the concept of homosexuality revulsive. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it is, or that's encoded in our genes, but that ability to feel that way based on the cultures that we're raised in and our circumstances might play into that. So anyways, it was a fun conversation. I think the individual that was questioning this was a little bit trollish, but seemed to be genuinely interested and responded genuinely. So I thought, okay, well, you know, I'll go with the assumption that he is interested in having a discourse. So it was good. So yeah, it was nice, because I didn't have to let loose with a stream of invective.
No, and there was considerably less swearing than usual.
Yes, congrats. Much less than usual.
But yeah. Anybody who does read Feringula, check out Brownian, OM, because that's our boy right here.
Yeah.
So let's move on into what you were actually going to speak about tonight.
Well, what I wanted to talk about, and anybody who has been reading the news knows about the discovery of Gliese 581e, which is an exoplanet found orbiting the star Gliese 581, which is only 20,000 light years from us. And what's remarkable about this particular discovery, it was discovered by Swiss scientist Michel Mayer and his team at the University of Geneva. He and his team also happened to be the team that discovered 51 Pegasi b in 1995, the first exoplanet to be found at all. Orbiting an Earth-like star. But what makes this discovery so interesting is that this Gliese 581e is the most Earth-like planet to yet be discovered, in the sense that it's only 1.94 Earth masses, so only twice the weight, the mass of ours, and yet orbits a sun-like planet. It's of course too close. This one happens to be too close to its parent star, and thus is not in the habitable zone, so is really unlikely to have life in any form that we might recognize. But its discovery certainly implies that such planets around sun-like stars do exist, and are not only possible but likely. And it's interesting, as an aside, it was thought for a long time that these Earth-sized rocky planets weren't all that rare, but our detection techniques made them pretty well difficult to discover. As we've gotten better at doing that, we're finding more and more and more.
So it's not like these planets have suddenly popped into existence.
No, but our ability to see them has grown within the last 15 years. But that's not all. Orbiting Gliese 581 are three other planets, one of which was found, I think, in 2007, not too long ago. But it was initially thought to be much too far from the parent star to possibly harbor life, but now it appears to lie smack dab in the habitable zone. Now, this planet, Gliese 581d, is nearly eight times the mass of Earth, so it's likely to be too large to be just rocks alone, but probably contains ice. And planets that contain ice and exist in the habitable zone occasionally have liquid oceans, or at least one of those such planets do that. And similarly, one of those such planets also harbor life. So it does say a lot about the likelihood of us being able to detect other planets in the universe that might actually have life. And I mean, further, according to NASA's PlanetQuest site, there are 346 planets orbiting 292 stars. So, I mean, that's tons out there that we've been finding over the last 15 years, you know, from back from the days that we only found one. So far, none of these are really Earth-like, as they're usually too large, too small, or outside the habitable zone. But given our increasing ability to detect them, it's in fact, the discoverers of this have hypothesized that it's only within the, that it's relatively a short period of time before we start finding planets that do contain life other than our own, which means the likelihood of seeing some future Captain Kirk doing the warp of shame from some green girl's
you
planet
are
one
such
morning.
A dork. Honestly,
I was actually talking to our favorite skeptic Nathan, our first caller in today, and I ran this joke by him, and he said, "No, it wasn't Captain Kirk that slept with the green girl. That was so and so, Christopher Pike." And started off with a pilot, and so then I kind of glazed over because he was killing the joke. I mean, it's true, but so anyways. Okay, so I meant to change that to blue girl because I'm pretty sure Kirk had a couple of those.
When you talk about life, though, we're not talking about, you know, beings that appear like us necessarily.
We're talking about exactly that human looking being. No, not at all. That's probably really unlikely.
I'm going to slap you after the show. Okay,
yeah,
good.
And anybody who's if you've read a great book on it, Wonderful Life, Stephen Jay Gould's book talks about why it is the case that we happen to be who we are and look like we are, and why it's based on contingency, and that it's really unlikely that you'd ever find the circumstances that would create bipedal, hairless mammal type vertebrates roaming around
hot,
yeah, watching Twitter or reading Twitter and that sort of thing. So that's probably not the case.
We've come to this.
But unfortunately, even though this planet is only 20.45 light years away, real life physics, not the Kirk kind, says that faster than light travel is almost guaranteed to be impossible. I've got a link to a site where somebody had done a study, and they were investigating the idea of creating stable universes that you might be able to move on, and leaving aside the energy constraints about creating such a thing, that they wouldn't be stable enough or be inundated with Hawking radiation. So it's unlikely that we'd even be able to use that. So it's kind of unfortunate because it means that the knowledge that these planets exist does about as much for our ability to travel to them as the fact that Sarah Palin can see Alaska or can see Russia from her house gives her foreign expertise. Oh, too soon?
Too soon.
Too soon? Well, still one can dream, right? Gliese 581E for president in 2012.
It'll always be too soon.
Those are dark days.
yes, and thank goodness they're over. So anyways, if you want more of exoplanets in a vain attempt to identify E.T.'s planet and recapture your youth in the days way before drug addiction amongst teen and child actors, check out the blog. I'll have a link to the Extrasolar Planets Encyclopedia. And that's the encyclopedia spelled with an A-E, which means it's more reliable than the regular old encyclopedias spelled with just a P-E-D-I-A. And then if you'd like to read some more science blogs coverage, if unlike me, you do leave Ferengula once in a while and go haunt somebody else's blog, check out Starts With a Bang and Dynamics of Cats, which seems
really
to be, yes, this seems to dabble in, astronomy and... But lately, all the posts have been sort of Twitter-like in short brevity. But anyways...
Why cats?
Both good. I don't know. I just noticed that there was a link, and I was reading about that particular article, but I hadn't had enough time to really delve into the blog to find out what exactly it is about dynamics of cats that relate to planets.
Listeners, or suns or stars. Please do find out about that and let us know what one has to do with the other. Wow, it's an interesting note to end on right there.
Yes.
And moving on.
Yes, and
all
moving
right.
on.
All right. Thanks, Brownian.
Thank you.
So we're gonna see if James is here on the line with us. Are you there, James?
Hi. I think I am.
Okay, we can hear you. Perfect.
Sweet. So, you guys were talking last week about the genetics, or not genetics, but the neurology of sex.
Well, right, and we were actually speaking about the biological roots of romantic love, and then we sort of veered off into gender and such, but you called right at the end of the show, and I was actually mildly infuriated because you had a lot to talk about, so we coerced you into coming on the show, which is what we do, because we are all about audience participation here at Skeptically Speaking. So thank you for being here, James.
Thank you. So anyways, your sexuality is actually based in your midbrain sites. It's in your limbic system, basically.
Okay.
And for men, it actually starts off where your sexuality is based in your amygdala. When your amygdala, it's named after a little almond, And basically, that's where all of your aggression and all of your fear and everything comes from. And so it's kind of cool when you think about it that way, because it can lead to a bunch of different weird kinks and that kind of stuff when you think about it, and just how sexually physical a lot of men get. And so that's one theory behind it all. But then from there, your brain, it actually has a couple main areas. One is called the medial preoptic area. Medial preoptic, it just means where it's located in your brain. It's around your optic nerve, or your optic area of your brain. It's around the back of your head. And basically, that has like a lot of testosterone receptors, and it's totally sexually dimorphic for depending if you're male or female. And that's also where your sexuality is based. It depends on whether you are male or female for which receptors that you have going in there. Mm-hmm. But it's also more than that. It's if you identify yourself as being a transsexual or something along those lines,
right,
your brain chemistry in that area will actually match what you associate yourself, not your actual sex.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how does that happen?
So, it's actually very... They're not quite entirely sure. These are all surveys and studies that haven't really been able to be done again.
Okay.
A lot of the science behind all of this is actually done by homosexual researchers. And one of them, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but he was probably one of the best in the world. And because he was homosexual, this was an issue that he actually really cared about. And since him, I don't think anyone's really had the skill to redo the survey.
So it was a survey. Was it like a neurological test of any kind? Like, did they do MRIs or...
It was MRI, but it was also more dissection and that kind of stuff, because you're looking into it and you're basically using very, very strong microscopes, and you're looking at different receptor sites, and you're trying to basically keep the brain alive in some parts. It's a lot of testing on animals. Like boa chimps, they're actually very similar to humans in the way that their brains are set up. And so I'm not totally advocating or saying you should go test an animal, blah, 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 don't kill me. But that's basically what they did.
Okay. Actually, when you and I were talking on the phone, you were talking about the neurological origin of male sexuality and how it's rooted in the same place that fear and aggression is.
Yes, that was the amygdala. But there's also another area of your brain called the nucleus accumbens. And that is actually where your dopamine pathways go. And the nucleus accumbens, it's actually really easy to screw up. And so that means that's where you can get all your really weird kinks from. Like, if you really get off on listening to Elton John, something went wrong with your nucleus accumbens.
Wow, there really is a kink for everything, isn't there?
Yeah. And that's because this is so easy to manipulate. And basically, anything that you're doing while you're also having a lot of dopamine going through your body is going to change your sexuality. And that's why a lot of drug addicts and that kind of stuff, their sexuality is very screwed up. Because when you start doing drugs like cocaine, it actually starts to follow your dopamine pathways. And so then it gets mixed in with your sexuality. And soon, if you keep having drugs while you're doing sex, you won't be able to have sex without doing drugs at the same time.
Huh. Okay. Well, how does pair bonding fit in with this?
Okay. Pair bonding, that is where it's like monogamy. And so you can actually look at monogamy in a lot of different animals based on their brain and the way the brains are set up. And there is actually certain areas within your medial preoptic area. And you have little sight receptors for different chemicals, depending if you're male or female. For female, it's oxytocin, and for males, it's vasopressin. And basically, the more receptors that you have in this area, the more likely you are to become a mate for a different organism over a long period of time. So organisms with a lot of vasopressin receptors in their brain, males, they're going to be more likely to be monogamous to a different female. So the more often you have sex with that female, the more likely you want to have sex with that. But there's also a way to increase the receptors inside that localized area, where you basically irradiate that small area of the brain. And once you start irradiating this area of the brain, you are getting a lot more receptors. And the more receptors you have, the more likely you want to have sex with that same individual again and again and again. However, there is another syndrome. Oh, I can't think of the name of it. It's named after a president. which is kind of awkward. That's going to bother me. It's like one of the useless presents for the U.S. Well, there are a lot of them, but it's one of the more useless ones. But it's basically where you get bored of your mate. And they don't know why this happens exactly, but this could have to do with the oxytocin and vasopressin receptors in your brain. They could be going dead, or it could be a billion other things. Like, it could be you smell something different on a new receptor, or on a new mate, or something like that. So basically, the more you have sex with a person, as long as your vasopressin and oxytocin receptors are still good, you'll keep getting more and more attracted to them. However, as soon as they stop going and they stop firing and you stop receiving the messages, you get bored of that person and you want to move on. And so a lot of people actually say this goes in cycles of 4 years, because that's basically how long it takes for a marriage and divorce rate, blah, 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 for pretty much most cultures.
Interesting.
And so they're saying that these receptors have a life period.
So have you heard, there was actually a fairly recent study. It was an article that I was reading not long ago about researchers creating an oxytocin spray. Did you hear about that at all? Apparently you...
No, I haven't.
It was something, and I'll try and find the article and I'll post it on the blog. And listeners, if anybody knows what I'm talking about, feel free, call in.
Was it supposed to be like...
to keep your mate with you.
Or?
It was supposed to be to keep your mate with you. So basically, it would spray this oxytocin solution in the face. And they would love you forever. Really. I am not joking. So I'm going to have to find that article and I'll post it.
There is some stuff for that, but it's more through pheromones as well. And so I'm guessing they're trying to make oxytocin go through a pheromone pathway.
Interesting. Okay. Well, actually, since we're on that topic, where are we with pheromones in humans? Because I know we haven't found them, but...
The pheromones are totally real in humans. It's very controversial, and they're not as potent as they are in a lot of animals because we're more social creatures. And I can say we're more social because if you were to castrate like a male when he's very, very young, he's not going to have sex very much later on.
Right.
But if you castrate like a 40-year-old man, he's still going to have sex constantly. It's a social construct for how often they have sex.
Huh.
Even if they no longer have the biological drive to do it, because it becomes so ingrained sociologically within our minds, it's in our frontal lobe, then it's an action that we just keep repeating.
So, okay, so how does this relate to pheromones? Because I thought we found where the receptor could be. Is that the last thing I heard? But we didn't find...
Well, there's a billion receptors for pheromones. You can't just say that there's a single receptor for them. It's all through your limbic system for the most part for your sex drive.
Okay.
But there's several different receptors for them. Pheromones... We don't really have too many that work well in humans because most of the pheromones that we're working with, they're actually derived from other animals. Just like cologne and perfume. Perfume used to be derived from skunk glands because it had very, very strong sexual receptors in them. Sexual drugs, basically, that just go right into your limbic system for if you're a skunk. But it also works for females to an extent. And for males, the one that works for females is if you actually put male urine on your face.
Oh.
Or if you drench yourself in male urine, because it also contains a lot of these pheromones that females pick up.
I don't want a boyfriend that bad.
And you can also change the way this is working in your medial preoptic area and your nucleus accumbens. That's where you're changing your sexuality because you have a way of impairing these receptor sites or making them even more receptive. And basically, that's how straight guys stay straight and straight girls stay straight and gay guys stay gay. They turn these receptors on and off. And so everybody, when you look at a pretty face, you will acknowledge that it's a pretty face. But if you're a male and you acknowledge yourself as being straight and you're looking at a very attractive male face, you're going to impair your receptors for your pheromones, for several different things, actually. For your... estrogen receptors, actually, that's a different area altogether, but you impair this all, and the odd part is when you make eye contact with someone, these pathways, they don't always impair perfectly, and so that's where you start to get the blurring sexuality.
You know, you are a fascinating individual. Can you just, you know, without going into too much detail, but what is your background right now?
I want to be a bio teacher when I'm older.
That's awesome.
Basically, I have like a ton of neurological courses and that kind of stuff, and I'm in my last year of my education degree.
Oh, which means you're still excited about this. That's fantastic. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And we're, you know what? I have your phone number now. So you realize you're going to get a call to talk about something else on this subject at some point.
Okay, perfect.
Oh,
thank you.
Lovely. Thanks, James.
Thanks, James.
Bye.
Okay. We're just going to jump to a promo here, and hopefully we'll have some UFO talk coming soon. Here at Skeptically Speaking, we encourage you to call in and question everything. During tonight's episode, you can call in at 780-492-CJSR, extension 1, to join in on the conversation. Again, that number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. If you're a little bit shy, please email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or message Skeptical Radio on Twitter. After the show, feel free to comment on tonight's episode at skepticallyspeaking.com. We'd also love to see you join our Skeptically Speaking Facebook group or have you follow Skeptical Radio on Twitter. Of course, if you want to reach us the old school way, you can always email us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Hey everyone, we're back, and the promo is playing again there, I believe. Sorry about that.
Holly.
We had just had a couple technical difficulties in getting
Surprise.
Jim on the line. We are actually going to just get a couple buttons going here so we can have him join us.
Okay.
You can still hear us okay there, Jim?
Yes, I can.
Okay, we were having a little trouble. We had a wrong number, unfortunately, so we were kind of scrambling on our end in the 52 seconds we had to play a promo. We had about 10 of silence after that, then we got you on, luckily. But not enough about us. How about a little bit about you? I think Des will start off with a little bit of an introduction here.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for being here.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm well so far. Just a little intro for everybody. You are listening again to Skeptically Speaking on either CJSR, Free Thought Radio, WPRR, Citywide LP, or via podcast. And we're here today with Jim Maroney, director of the Alberta UFO Study Group and the author of The New Bridge. He's appeared in local and national media, and he's a recognized speaker at UFO conferences. And he's spoken on topics like contact, scientific process of understanding, and planning for the extraterrestrial presence, UFOs, what we know and how we should prepare. Thanks for being here, Jim.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on your show.
Oh, absolutely. So again, anybody, the number to call in if you're listening on CJSR or live online is
492-2577, extension 1.
You are such a dork. Or you can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. And if you're listening via other station or podcast, please don't call in as you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we don't live in the studio. So, Jim, what does the Alberta UFO Study Group do?
Well, really, it's just a website that I maintain. I collect information on UFO sightings and reports. I disseminate information from national organizations, from national media as well, on major UFO events that are happening, not just on a national basis, but international as well, including Great Britain, the UK in general, Europe. But a lot of the information too also comes to us from the United States.
Okay, so it's mainly a clearinghouse for all the information that you find out about UFOs.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so it might go without saying, but what are UFOs?
Well, I think the easiest answer to that question is that we have to accept the fact that at least some UFOs are extraterrestrial craft, some are not. The challenge, obviously, for us has been to decipher, what are alien spacecraft, if that's maybe probably a kind of a funny definition or a funny explanation for it, because we don't really know what the crafts themselves really are. Some of them seem to morph, some of them, and we have some very, very good video footage recently that's come out. I'd say within the last 10 years or so. So I think it's safe to assume, and I think I'm very confident saying that at least some of the sightings that we see are definitely extraterrestrial craft of unknown origin.
Okay, well, I guess one of the things I want to talk about is sort of the leap in logic. How does one go from an unidentified flying object to must be aliens?
Well, I think that when you look at, for example, the 1990 incident that had happened in Belgium, where they'd actually sent up fighter jets to investigate this particular craft that had also been witnessed by thousands of people on the ground, had actually been filmed on the ground as well, and that by people on the ground, we have reports from people that are trained observers by any stretch of the imagination. And we also have other evidence, including not just the video footage, but we have multiple radar contacts, and the craft itself exhibits characteristics that go well beyond what we would consider to be conventional aircraft.
Okay, well, when you're talking about witnesses, that's always something that's it's problematic, because people's memories are notoriously faulty and they don't quite know what they've seen, and so it's almost like pareidolia. They tend to draw patterns where they can. The brain tries to do that. So one of the things that you've lectured about is a scientific process of understanding UFOs. So can you tell me how you would use the scientific process to research stuff like this?
Well, are you asking, like, what's this general science behind the understanding of the UFO phenomenon, or how we decipher what a UFO actually is?
Actually, I would say, how do you research these sightings, first of all?
Oh, okay. Really, my personal goal on this one is not really specifically researching every individual report that we have on the UFO phenomenon. So, but we do know that when you start looking at what you consider to be a reliable report, you have to consider the integrity of the witnesses that were there. You have to consider multiple things, such as, you know, what do they, is there any supporting documentation, or is there any supporting reports associated with their particular sighting? You could look at radar sightings, you could look at radar imaging, you could look at video footage, and that would have to be confirmed by multiple witnesses as well. And I think you're touching on a very good point here, and that is the fact that, I mean, there's a lot of crap out there on the internet, you know.
Oh, yes.
You know, we have to really, I think you have to have a really discerning eye with respect to the phenomenon itself, and not accept every single report as being legitimate. That goes without saying. I mean, any good scientific investigation has to rule out the fact that we see hoaxers and that, and we also see just false reporting. Now, for those people who do report to us, what we find is very interesting. About 80% of the people who actually do file reports want to file them anonymously. They don't want their name to be shared with the public, and they don't want a lot of media attention to it.
Understandable.
And, you know, and part of that has to go, there's still, within our culture right now, there's still quite a bit of fear of talking about the phenomenon itself in a meaningful way that we should be talking about it, because for so long, so many people have been ridiculed for their beliefs on it. But right now, I mean, people should feel much more comfortable about speaking about it, because there's so many, I would say, you know, people in high positions, you know, military positions and political positions that are stepping forward and saying, you know, we have to take this seriously. This is probably one of the greatest challenges that humanity has faced or will be facing in the future, and it was something that is going to certainly affect all of us at some point.
Well, actually, you touched on it there. A former Canadian defense minister has actually been outspoken about his belief in UFOs quite recently.
Yes, it's interesting. You know, I actually had an opportunity to speak with him directly once, and he's a fascinating gentleman. And, you know, he had nothing to gain by coming up and saying this, but ultimately, you know, he's a person of character. And by that, I mean, you know, he really is saying this and doing this for all the right reasons. And, you know, he told me, you know, quite bluntly, you know, and I said, you know, can we approach the federal government and try and push the idea forward that we want more disclosure about the phenomenon itself? You know, and really maybe hold some public public meetings on it, and but again, you know, he says, I don't think they're really going to be open to it, at least at this point in time. You know, that might change in the near future, but at least this point in time, they're not, he said, I don't think they'd be that open to it. But what has been interesting is that the, you know, Canada has opened at least some of its files on the UFO phenomena that go back many, many, many years.
Yeah, and, I was looking at those.
Yeah. So I can just give you a brief on this. So, I mean, 2007, France, Britain, and Canada essentially opened up some files to the public, and then Denmark followed suit this past January. And we have some 9,000-plus Canadian files which were released in February 2009 of this year.
How many in Alberta?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know how many exactly that have come out of that 9,000, but what we see on an annual basis for reports is somewhere around 150 reports a year, somewhere in that neighborhood, 140 reports a year. And one of the things that's interesting also about this reporting process is that the data collection process, from a scientific standpoint, has a lot of holes in it, if I'm going to put it that way. And by that I mean we don't have a central system for collection of the data and evaluation of the data. And that really presents us with a problem, because we also have to recognize that almost, when you look at all this data that's coming into us, we have to realize that we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. You know, maybe 10% of all the reports that are actually being cited. So we have a lot of reports that go missing or don't make it to these reporting centers and collecting of data.
Actually, because I do want to talk about the Canadian UFO site by the Government of Canada. So what kind of... There's a lot of similarities to a lot of those sightings.
Yes.
Can you go over some of those?
Well, I don't really like to comment on things I don't know too much about, you know, specifically. And I don't honestly know exactly what sightings you're looking at with respect to that particular site. But what I could say in a general sense is that they incorporate a kind of a wide variety of different types of sightings that we see. You know, and what's interesting, I think, is in some cases, some of the discussions that have actually happened as a result of that. You know, we have government departments talking with government departments. We have mentions of, you know, the United States and what Canada is doing with respect to the United States. And, you know, I think in a sense, Canada has taken a lead role in one way, and that is we've said, hey, you know what, we will demonstrate that we have files on the UFO phenomenon, and we are not just showing them for the public, but we are allowing or inviting at least, to some extent, some scientific scrutiny over that, which, when you really have to ask yourself, and why hasn't the government really come up and said, you know what, for all the kind of money we throw here, there, and everywhere, why aren't we putting even a penny towards understanding the phenomenon and asking for a scientific and public inquiry into it? It's interesting. You know, I think that they're struggling with the phenomenon. They're struggling, just like with most governments in the world, what to do about it.
Well, I think one of the issues is that would you consider anything that's in those documents, or actually not just those documents, but anything that you've read or you've had experience with, would you consider that evidence? Because it seems like the government doesn't. And because it's mostly anecdotal, again.
Yeah. I think that when you look at the whole phenomenon, it's a very complex phenomenon in general. And by that I mean you have scientists that are on one side of the fence saying there's nothing to it. Then you have scientists on the other side of the fence saying there's absolutely something to it. When you look at all the evidence, it's quite obvious to anybody that's reasonable and open-minded that the evidence is overwhelming that there's something to it. And, you know, we're finding that the detractors against the UFO phenomena really either haven't studied the data in an honest and reliable way. And right now, then, what the question is why hasn't there been more effort put forward into understanding this particular phenomenon and sharing the information with the public? And, of course, that again goes to the problems that exist within the phenomena. You know, we have the military that's withholding some information. We have politicians which are damn nervous about saying anything about the phenomena. I mean, how would you, you know, strike a platform and say, well, I'm going to promote the idea that we investigate the phenomena and please vote for me?
Well, yeah, I would say that you and I look at the phenomena differently because, although I agree, reading a lot of these cases, there's no direct, you know, evidence for what it is. But whereas I would look at it, and a lot of people would look at it and say, this is really weird, we have no idea what this is. Somebody in the UFO movement would say it's obviously an alien. And it's that leap in logic. It's how do you get from we don't know what the heck those lights are to this is evidence of life on another planet. Like, do you have anything? Can the UFO movement give me anybody that missing step?
I think, in fact, if you really consider the one episode in Belgium. You have video footage; it's clear. You have the military standing up and saying, "We have no idea what it was, and we tracked it on radar." And they made they went to the public and they showed the radar systems. They showed the craft taking off at incredible velocities, way outside our technological abilities, and they said, "We don't know what it is." And that's all. They don't want to take the next leap and say it's extraterrestrial. They're just saying we have no idea what it is, but it's obvious. I mean, it's operating at with a technology that's beyond ours. Well, what else would it be? If you look at the situation recently, and I'm just going to go to the most recent one, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, one of the most decorated astronauts in the astronaut program. He's finally come up and said, you know what? The extraterrestrial phenomenon is absolutely real. Well, this totally stunned NASA. I mean, I'm not making this up. I'm not. You can check it out with any news media outlet that are out there. You can talk to Dr. Edgar Mitchell yourselves, and I mean, it's obvious that his belief systems are consistent with that. He's a PhD. He's one of the people that landed on the moon, and he's not the only astronaut that's actually stepped forward and said something along these lines. You know, we have to consider that.
Okay, and we are having people email in since they can't get through on the phone. People do keep trying to get through on the phone, but we have an email question here.
Sure.
Actually, there's two questions that someone sent in. What does your guest think about the Raelians?
About the what?
The Raelians. And from my understanding of conspiracy theories, they're a race of aliens who live on Earth and they look like lizards. Vaguely Illuminati-like. Okay. Have you heard about this at all?
I heard a little bit about it, but I don't subscribe to that theory at all. I mean, it's really a... To me, it's when you look, there's no evidence to support that whatsoever. There's no scientific evidence to support the idea of aliens or whatever. We don't know what these races are. We know that they're advanced. That's about all we know at this point. About aliens, no. That's, to me, there's no scientific, you know, evidence to support it.
Okay, well, there's another question that this person has in the same vein, which is, does he think that God could be an alien? Or that aliens made Earth and are stopping by to check up on their creation?
No.
Okay. So that's too crazy.
I think maybe along that vein that my belief system is certainly this, and that is, you know, if you have an advanced society, a more developed society than us, even a more technologically advanced society, then you correspondingly have to have a more mature, spiritually developed society. So, you know, are they spiritually more advanced than us? Well, I hope so. And it would seem to be consistent if they're certainly technologically more advanced. You know, humanity, when you look at us from a, you know, when you look at us, essentially, you have to define humanity in the terms of both its technological achievements and its lack of spiritual development. And there's a tremendous imbalance in that particular area. So I think, you know, we're certainly struggling with that. And, you know, if beings were, I could believe these beings are here, and I believe they're certainly curious as to, and more than just curious, I think they're very concerned about the current state of human development and human evolution.
Okay, so you actually subscribe to the belief that there's like a benevolent race of some kind that's looking out for us or attempting to?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call them benevolent entirely. I think there's a definition that's going to be redefining itself in the near future, but I certainly believe that they have our best interests at heart. I believe that what we're contending with right now is some form of contact. It's just that contact is not occurring in any way that anybody had predicted. And this has really delayed our understanding and, in fact, delayed our response to it. I'm not sure if we're ever going to get to the point where we can fully accept what's actually happening, but we really need to basically address it as quickly as we possibly can. Obviously, that's my conjecture to it.
So what exactly gives you that impression? Because, you know, if it's a leap to suggest that there are aliens visiting Earth, it's more like a pole vault, really, to claim that you know what they're thinking.
Well, for me, essentially, you know, I was out in Winnipeg back over 22 years ago, and I hate to say this, but well, maybe I don't hate to say it, but I actually did have a direct encounter. It was a very brief one, and it certainly shook me. I can tell you, you know, it was something I was totally unprepared for, and that's really all I want to see about that. I don't want to go into too much detail with it, but
because I know you haven't spoken about this, and you've been pretty clear about not wanting to speak about this issue.
Well, I think that that's not entirely true, because I have spoken about it in public when I find a lot of people being really curious about my experience. But it's my experience is one that I kind of want to hold to my heart and not share it to too many people, in a sense, because I don't want to color everybody's perception of the phenomena itself. I mean, I'm fully aware that my experiences impact my interpretation of the world, and certainly my interpretation of the events that are transpiring with with the phenomena itself and the extraterrestrial phenomena. But I've taken time, a long, long time, to kind of assess what my personal experiences are and how it correlates with the rest of the world's experiences on the phenomenon. To me, and my understanding of the phenomenon now, and with my experience, I feel very comfortable in saying, you know, they certainly are here trying to help us. They're not a malevolent race by any stretch of the imagination, but humanity's interaction with them is very, very difficult. I think our response to them is going to be a struggle to understand them. They're certainly probably struggling to find a way to interact with us. So really, it's no longer a question of, is there extraterrestrial life out there and how will humanity interact with it? It's more of a question of, the extraterrestrials are here and how are they interacting with us? I think that's a new set of questions and a new paradigm shift that we're going to have to make.
Okay, we have another email question. How does one dismiss one alien story while believing in all the others? And I think he's referring to the Raelian issue.
Yeah. Wow, you know what? I don't know how you do it. I know how I do it. You know, there's ways to understand the world around us. And one of the most powerful ways that we understand the world around us is our own experiential learning. And that can never be downplayed. So part of that experiential learning for myself certainly has colored my view and certainly maybe has cleared up a lot of misconceptions that I may have had in the past about UFOs or anything else like that. How does a person go sorting through all the garbage that's out there and really understanding what's actually happening? You know what? Good luck. If you look at all this stuff that's been written on UFOs, you could take 90% of it. It's not worth the paper it's written on, and you can get rid of it. So you're stuck with 10%, and yet you don't have a definitive way to sort through it and figure out, well, out of that 10%, how do I grasp in the conceptual way what's actually going on in the world? Maybe the best way to start is the most conservative way to start, and that is look at the best scientific evidence that we have to date.
You know, which would be what?
I think that's probably the best way to and start conservatively. You know, if we could get to the point that we can accept the phenomenon in Israel, I think that's stage one.
Okay, tell me what the best scientific evidence is at the moment?
Well, I think the scientific evidence speaks for itself. If you look at some of the reporting that has been done in the investigation, which includes military officials. We have public officials, politicians that have come up and said that the phenomenon is real. If you consider it in the basis, I remember I hear the story about, well, there's no physical evidence to support the phenomenon. And you asked, well, what do you define as physical evidence? Well, something that you hold in your hand. Well, there's a whole lot of other evidence other than just something that you can hold in your hand that will meet scientific criteria. Well, and that
sorry, if I may jump in there. You had mentioned that, and you might have more to this, but it comes down to a lot of perhaps politicians or high-profile figures who have, you know, said their perspective on the issue. I know from a scientific background, anecdotal evidence like that isn't really taken. It doesn't matter who's saying it. It doesn't really come down to a, you know, solid, tangible evidence. It doesn't have to be tangible in the fact that you hold it, but maybe it's a measurable phenomenon where you can actually, you know, see a cause and effect that can't be explained through any other method.
Well, I think it goes back, and again, I'm not just mentioning one aspect of it. I'm trying to put it in a context of all the evidence that's available out there. And when you take it in, you know, when we have sites that have had landings that have taken place and have left physical traces behind, that counts as physical trace evidence. If you have it on independent radar systems, and that is ground-based radar systems and aerial-based radar systems, then that counts as evidence. When you have people of that are essentially trained observers, that are scientists, that come forward and say they've reported these objects, that they've seen these objects, that they have them documented, that counts as evidence. You know, when you have people in power of positions who have also come up forward and said, no, we've been aware of that, and yes, this thing is absolutely true. I mean, Mikhail Gorbachev, the former president of the Soviet Union, stepped forward once and said, yeah, this phenomenon is absolutely real. And a lot of people don't realize that. None of that, when you have a former president of a country like Russia stepping forward and saying that, I think that's something worth taking note of. And again, we look at the thousands and thousands of pieces of data that are out there and available to us. I think we have to take a serious look at it.
We have another email question. There are many videos of UFOs. How does one identify a hoax?
I'm not a video expert. I think that you have to look at, if there is nobody willing to step forward and say, I took this video, in other words, if it's an anonymous video that comes forward, you can't accept that information. I think I would dismiss that right away. Someone has to basically step forward and say, I took this video. That way, if it's fraudulent, they should take the hit for it as well. So, you know, yeah, that's the main thing right there. You know, just if it's anonymous, then really I don't think you should waste your time even looking at the video.
Okay, we have another email question. Thanks, everybody, by the way, for emailing in. I don't know what's with our phone lines. Okay, so this one says, the idea of aliens only emerged in popular culture during the last century. Science fiction, The Outer Limits, I believe, first depicted the gray aliens in the 30s, and there were not reports of human/alien contact before that point. Previous to this, people would claim to see angels, although they still do. My questions are people really seeing angels? Is it possible that there are really both angels and aliens, or are they the same thing? And if they're the same thing, why did the descriptions of the phenomena change to resemble the Outer Limits depiction after it was popularized by culture?
Well, you know, I don't know specifically. I can say that, like, I don't know with a definitive answer for that particular question. However, I do concur that phenomena itself may have some historical roots well past, or, you know, well into our past, certainly before the 1940s, the mid-1940s. When the phenomenon really started to come into our cultural mind, it was actually around the mid-1940s, and that was shortly after Second World War, particularly right after the advent of our nuclear weapons. And that's when the phenomenon really started to take off. And you know, the reporting of what these beings looks like there's a more North American view, but there's other views that people reported in other countries, and they see them a little bit differently. We don't really understand specifically that we, you know, I'm certainly one that believes that the phenomenon is real and that these beings are here. The question now becomes, you know, how many of them are here? We don't know. We don't know how many races are interacting with us. It seems at least one race has taken a lead role, but we don't know how many there really are. The aspect of the spiritual stuff where you know, maybe we've perceived them as angels and now we perceive them a little bit differently is certainly probable. We're likely dealing with a consciousness that's much more evolved than human consciousness. So this makes the interpretation of what individuals are experiencing when they're in the presence of these beings somewhat of conjecture. So there is very likely a significant psychological component to the interaction with these beings. But again, it's undefined at this point. There was a situation in Africa where we had, you know, some 49 to 50 school children reporting an object and beings, and they all reported the same type of being, the same look of these beings. So maybe from that point of view, we can say, well, it seems that there's actually a physical presence to these beings that we can, you know, that's measurable in some sense. But again, I'm not entirely sure how this interaction is actually occurring from a conscious level.
Well, Jim, we do have one last email that might kind of tie into this idea. If we accept the claims that the guest makes, what difference does it make in our lives? What is this? What is your takeaway message? Why should we care about shy ETs that obviously do not want to make themselves known?
Right. Well, here is the conundrum. And this is the way I've come to understand it. You know, they have actually decided to make themselves known, and they're giving us about 60-some-odd years to kind of put it in perspective. They're leaving it with us to kind of decide how we as a society are going to respond to them. The interesting part of their process of contact, at least to this point, appears to be that they either are interested in individuals that are not, and not necessarily specifically, you know, what race you're a part of or what your IQ level is or anything else like that. They seem to be more interested in interacting with individuals from an individual level. But obviously, they are also showing themselves from a distance to larger populations. And certainly the phenomenon, the number of reports that have been going up from year to year are suggestive that the phenomenon itself is actually changing. In other words, the ETs are actually changing in a way they are interacting with us. So the phenomenon is changing. This is the reason why we're trying to hold on to this data and try and be as scientific as an evaluation process as we can to try and monitor the number of sightings and those types of things. And yet we know that's also impacted by social stigma that's associated with it. So I think, though, it's very important that we can believe, at least to this point, and assume that there is a plan. These beings are going to be smarter than us. So they've obviously adopted, and this is my assumption, they've obviously adopted a plan to interact with human beings. And it would really be in our best interest then to understand that plan and even promote it if that's the case.
Well, that's an interesting final thought there. We do have to cut you off. It is 7 o'clock here, and that's the end of our hour.
So thanks very much to Jim Maroney for being on the line with us this evening. It's a very interesting topic that there's no way that we can cover this all in the amount of time that we have. And thanks also very much to James for allowing us to coerce him into coming on the show earlier. Thanks to everyone, as always, that's involved with the show, whether producing, fixing technical issues, answering phones, providing random science-y knowledge, or simply listening to the program. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
We'll see you then.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall out, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies. Angels don't run when we die. All the hippies are working.